on Studio B every Thursday, 1700 hours Pacific Time. That's 8 p.m. Eastern. No topic taboo, no subject too strange. I strive to take a neutral standpoint during the dissection of the topic at hand. That's Reality Extraction with Mr. Rowe on Revolution Radio.
Oscar's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows you're screwed.
Your body's filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not. Your heart's beating fast. It's getting a little harder to breathe. The neurobiological system is telling it to run. But your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener-supported radio. Reporting the danger. Unafraid. Right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. Revolution. Radio!
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Cosmic Catastrophe on Revolution Radio. I am your host, Diamond, from the Oppenheimer Ranch Project, and joining us today is my lovely partner and co-host, Leah Shaper.
Hello.
Wearing her handmade jewelry today.
This is my new line.
We've got a great show. There's been a lot of chit-chat on the interwebs, TikTok, and between what I like to call YouTube archaeologists. Mm-hmm. And Joe Rogan just had Graham Hancock and this other dude named, I forget, Dibble or Trent?
I don't remember either.
It's Dibble. But the one guy is claiming Graham Hancock is a white supremacist and blah, 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 all this stuff. It's kind of crazy what's going on. Other people think, other archaeologists call Graham Hancock a hack.
He's just old.
But we're going to get to the bottom of it because Graham Hancock put out his latest blog on his website, and we're going to talk about that. What I find interesting is that Graham Hancock's whole life has been writing pseudo-fiction type books about this lost civilization of the Ice Age. The funny thing is that what we're going to talk about today is evidence that they're not lost. We know exactly where these people are at the Ice Age transition.
Well, I it's funny, too, because in his blog piece, he kind of addresses that, like what the definition of lost really is and what he's actually means by that. And I think that he's, at least at this point anyway, he's using it more as like it's like this is a civilization we haven't fully identified and recognized, and we don't know the full scope of where it was and when exactly it was and who it influenced.
Yeah, I think my position would be that there were civilizations all over during the Ice Age, and when the catastrophe happened, not many of them made it. And those that made it, and they are now parts of us today.
Sure, sure. But, you know, you can also make the argument, as we've discussed many times before, that it's quite possible that there was like a global civilization, right? Because we see similarities from, let's say, megalith to megalith or culture to culture that would suggest that there's a lot of communication going on globally, which is not something, you know, that is typically in the narrative.
No, it isn't. And we're going to focus our discussion on the Fertile Crescent region, specifically in Turkey, and all the megalithic sites that are occurring during the Ice Age transition. And you know the most famous one as Göbekli Tepe. If we have time, the second half, we might get to the Toba eruption, which I find – did you look at that at all, that article?
Yeah, I did.
I find it interesting that they're discussing a dry spell.
Yeah. And there, I took a look, not really in depth, but I took a look at the paper underpinning that article, and I'm a little skeptical about their methods, but
we will begin with the most fascinating topic, Graham Hancock and the lost civilization of the Ice Age. Let me know if you could see the screen.
I can.
Okay. So right on the front of his blog post published the 14th of April is the Saberk reliefs. Now, this is claimed to be the oldest carving motif, complex motif ever in history. So this is it. Interestingly enough, it doesn't date back that long ago.
Oh, but it is interesting that apparently this motif shows up in other places in the world where you have this man in between two large felines, and so here's, the left one typically having a phallus, the left feline anyway.
And this, you can see the phallus on the left feline.
Yeah. And then of course the man himself in this carving is actually holding his phallus.
And over here, it looks like a dude is about to get killed by a water buffalo.
Yeah.
Now, this is also what I want to bring to your attention, just to blow your mind from the beginning. The same exact lion, which appears to be from the same artist, is on the lion pillar in an enclosure in Göbekli Tepe.
Well, what do you know?
And so it is very clear that whoever did this lion here probably knew the guy that did this lion.
Right. In other words, it's continuous culture. You know, it's not it's not a spontaneous carving. It's there for a reason because it meant something.
No, and as we get on with later in the discussion here, we're going to bring up some other locations that are even older, like Karan Tepe, and even older, the oldest site, which is some of the most complex stuff, Ban Kuklu Tarla. Mm-hmm. The amount of jewelry and carvings and figurines, just mind-blowing, and that's dated all the way back to the Younger Dryas catastrophe, 12, 8, or 9. And at that site, there the archaeological Younger Dryas boundary is there, so the culture was there before and after.
That is the most fascinating thing about all of this, right? I mean, the sites in Anatolia, especially the ones that are related, show a continuous occupation for several thousand years, which by today's standards is quite a lot, right? Our civilizations do not last that long. And that they lasted that long through the Younger Dryas catastrophe, which is crazy.
Yeah, these people loosely were the Natufian culture. That this really gets set to the western part of the ocean here, which it would be Israel and that whole region.
Mm-hmm.
But the Natufians extend from 15,000 all the way to Göbekli Tepe time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. That's thousands of years. And what you can clearly see from this culture, if you do an archaeological study, is a slow progression of a Stone Age culture that's carving bowls and making homes and streets 15,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And as time progresses, thousands of years, it gets more and more complex, their society. They start to have ceremonial places. They're certainly watching the sun because Karan Tepe has an equinoctial marker, mm-hmm. And it looks like a mini version of Göbekli Tepe. But so we can see through archaeology this culture getting more and more advanced over periods of thousands of years.
Yeah.
You know, culminating in Göbekli Tepe, all that brilliance.
Yeah. I mean, in one respect, you know, considering that this is a culture that's living through major climactic changes, in one respect, it's not that astounding in the sense that the climactic changes that occurred with the Drunger Dryas were largely global, right? So where else are you going to go? Like, you're not going to escape. Leaving and going somewhere else isn't going to solve your problem. But what is so remarkable is that the culture and the technology seems to be increasing and improving through the climactic changes. And that's amazing.
Yeah. And the improvement is bizarro. We're talking about coming out of the last ice age here and the bowling Alarod warming through the first Dryas and then the younger Dryas event, which is a mini ice age lasting almost 1500 years.
Mm-hmm.
The society we're talking about gets more complex as we drop down to the bottom.
Yeah. Yep.
It's completely opposite of what you would think.
But also, you know, it appears that these cultures were, I mean, still in some respect persisting, let's say prior to the bowling Alarod, where there were sort of regular ups and downs in climactic conditions. So perhaps, you know, we fail to account for the fact that human beings were already sort of used to these crazy conditions.
Yeah, but the question is this: why does it appear as if all of a sudden this society gets more and more complex as far as their building types, their ceremonial sites, the T-pillar sites, the astronomical significance,
mm-hmm.
The quality of their bas-relief carving.
Mm-hmm.
It increases for a few thousand years as we're getting colder. Maybe
right.
It has to do with the fact that it's getting colder. More people have to work together to survive. And because of that, they start learning better stone carving techniques.
I don't know
the explanation.
You would think that you would be busier with your actual survival, right? If temperatures are dropping dramatically over a couple of thousand years, you're going to have to shift how you're eating and what you're growing and all of that. So you would think that that would be occupying enough of your time that it would be hard to find the time to devote to these cultural impacts. You know, it is really interesting.
There is some evidence that goes back as far as 20,000 years of farming, some grains, but it really doesn't kick in until around 11,700 here, which is this warming spike, the end of the ice age itself.
Yeah.
You would think that after the 12,800-year event, the mass extinction in North America, there would have been huge impacts over here in Asia as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that time, when they should be starving to death, it's like the Renaissance. And the same thing happened here in North America during the Maunder Minimum, when it was the coldest ever. During our society, we became amazing humans. We made violins. We made concert pieces. There is no explanation for the explosion in creativity based on the fact that it was cold and everyone sat inside.
Well, so
except
I was thinking
for cosmic rays might have something to do with
it. Oh, yeah, that's quite possible. And on a more mundane level, I was thinking that because, okay, one of the things that Graham Hancock points out in his latest blog piece from this month is that, you know, so we have this idea that we start becoming civilized, right? When we start staying in one place and we start doing agriculture. And the argument is typically that we do the agriculture first and then we sort of become stuck to one place. But he's suggesting that it's the opposite, that it's when we stick ourselves in one location and stay there, and then we develop the agriculture, which actually makes some sense to me, right? Because once you're in one place, you actually have the time to devote to playing around with growing seeds and how they do and how much you have to water and whatever it is. But so maybe given that the younger Dryas catastrophe is a global event and there's really nowhere to escape to, I mean, maybe this is the point where people are really starting to stay in place and they stop moving around so much. And maybe that is part of the equation in terms of this higher culture developing.
Yeah, because if you made it through the Younger Dryas event when the skies turned dark and the earth rumbled for, you know, 48 hours or whatever happened, tsunamis washed 90% of the people away. Mm-hmm. If you made it, why would you leave? Because you made it there.
Right. It's like, okay, things are crazy, but we're like kind of okay here. So let's stay here and not move somewhere else. You know, let's not go to the coast where we might be impacted by a tsunami or whatever. Yeah, exactly.
And the connection between the Maunder minimum cooling and the Renaissance and this being a much larger version of that is kind of interesting.
Yeah, I do find your idea that an increase in cosmic rays in a period like this may have something to do with, you know, mental and spiritual changes that impact culture.
Which is good news because cosmic rays are at an all-time high. Yeah. And we're going into the cosmic ray maximum. So hopefully that may fix the problem, but the world is run by idiots. Speaking of, let's talk about Graham Hancock. In episode 5 of his documentary series, Ancient Apocalypse, released on Netflix in 2022, he talks about Göbekli Tepe in southeastern Turkey, which is reliably dated to 11,600 years ago. In this episode, he introduces it as the oldest megalithic archaeological site that has yet been discovered anywhere in the world. Now, this is just about a year and a half ago.
Yeah, I don't understand this statement. Because
for a man of his intellect and the fact that it, in a few seconds he could figure out that Bonkuklu Tarla is 1,500 years older and equally as impressive makes zero sense. More importantly, Bonkuklu Tarla has an enclosure completely carved out of bedrock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's more impressive than a T-pillar.
Well, it also leaves out of this equation, and granted, I don't think there's any consensus on dating, let's say, for sites like, well, Hancock doesn't believe that Egypt is any older than the official narrative, but it certainly could be. And then you have sites like Baalbek, you have sites in South America that appear to be extremely old. I don't think there's any consensus on that, but you could argue that those might be older than Göbekli Tepe.
Yeah, they would have to be pre-Diluvian, Sacsayhuaman, all the megalithic sites.
Yeah, yeah. And so I'm kind of like scratching my head about that because any limited amount of research would show that there's many reasons to think that sites like that are pre-Diluvian. Antediluvian would be the more correct term.
Antediluvian. Yeah. And so, yeah, very concerning that Hancock could be doing decades worth of work, writing all these books, and then getting this Netflix thing, and then making a statement as untrue as that.
I mean, it would be more accurate if he said something like, it's the oldest dated megalithic archaeological site. Like, I think you could, but even
no,
that.
Bonkuklu Tarla was right. Dated then.
Right, right. So, nope. Yeah, that's a little, I'm confused by that. Yeah.
All right. So that is the beginning of this 20-page expose, which I find quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So he spent more than 30 years on a controversial quest for a lost civilization of the Ice Age. You could say it's his obsession. So we kind of cleared that up in the beginning, that what we're looking for is that there was a high society. There was some type of seafaring civilization, the megalithic culture, we'll call them. Some even might say Atlantis. But clearly the ruins in Sacsayhuaman or in South America are not part of what Plato was talking about Atlantis. That was probably in the middle of the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to backtrack just a little bit. And just to be fair to Hancock here, while it is rather perplexing why he makes that statement in his Netflix episode and why he's repeating it here and starting his blog piece with this. Throughout this very lengthy blog piece, he does acknowledge the other sites in this area that are older than Göbekli Tepe and as like a continuous culture. So it's even more confusing to me that he makes that statement here.
Yeah, and he keeps going out on a limb with his theory. He says, nor did I grasp how much of the history of that transfer, even though it went unrecognized as such, had bit by bit begun to be revealed by archaeologists. He's talking about the discovery of Göbekli Tepe, it being so advanced, and well, that could have only have happened if some lost culture ended up on the shore here and taught these people how to do this stuff. That's completely insane.
Well, so, and I kind of feel like this whole blog piece is it's a long exercise in backtracking that statement a bit. Because ultimately what he says at the end of this blog piece is that it wasn't this like abrupt thing that these, you know, visitors from the high culture suddenly showed up and they built Göbekli Tepe and then things were changed here ever after. He rather acknowledges the idea that, okay, perhaps in the global catastrophe that was the Younger Dryas, that a vast majority of the high civilization was wiped out, and eventually kind of like the stragglers made their way to the various lower cultures around the world. And granted, like, that's not a terrible idea. Like, he points out that we still have a situation today where we have a modern high society, and at the same time we have, you know, tribes that live in the Amazon that have never seen a cell phone or anything like that, right? Like, you can definitely have that, where you have sort of two different levels of civilization going on at the same time. So the idea is the stragglers sort of make their way to the hunter-gatherer cultures and gradually help build a higher technology, higher culture society when they arrive there. Sort of where he lands.
Using that argument, then what happened during the Maunder Minimum when it got cold was the agrarian society at the time was visited by space aliens, which taught them how to make Stradivarius violins and be cultured and have all these scientific breakthroughs, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the thing, is that...
Which is, by the way, not what happened.
Right. Yes, thank you. And that's sort of where I take issue with this, is that you don't need the theory of a visiting high technology person to explain what we've found. You don't need that. You only need human beings as they are, which is highly intelligent, highly innovative, and this idea that, you know, we once weren't that, and that it took this very long, slow evolution to get there. I've said this many times on this show, that we constantly undersell human beings and our capabilities when we look backwards in time. And I think it's because it feeds our ego. Like, you know, we're like, oh, look how advanced we are now versus how low tech we were in the past. But I don't really think that was the case. I mean, I think we've had periods where we've been able to really show our abilities because the conditions allowed us to. And there are times where we were not able to do that as human beings. But I don't think we need visiting aliens and cultures that were far more advanced to explain the development of advancement in any particular culture. I just don't think it's necessary.
No, and physiologically, Homo sapiens 130,000 years ago were exactly the same as you and I, capable of having a podcast. They just didn't have the technology, the equipment, the science. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that if even in the limited history we know, we have lost ancient technologies in recent thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
So humans knew more things in the past than they currently do in the present.
Maybe, and they may have just known different things, or it could have been more. It could be one or the other, you know?
Yeah, so we're not dumber 10,000 years ago and getting smarter as time goes on. We're the same exact human. We just have less things at our fingertips, let's say.
Yeah.
We weren't more barbaric. There were barbarians thousands of years ago, but there are barbarians here on Earth today.
Absolutely. And again, to be fair to Hancock, he does say in this blog piece, he says, look, I never said that the lost civilization was far higher or far more intelligent than other people. I was just saying that the technologies and the ideas were different.
So it sounds like he's really backpedaling.
It does come off that way in the end.
Like he read some of the papers and he's like, wait a minute.
It does read like, I mean, he's definitely responding to criticism that he's received. But I mean, to be fair, like it's only been a year and a half since the Netflix episode. But, you know, it's also possible that he's looked at everything again and kind of reevaluated it. And I like to say that changing your mind is the sign of intellectual honesty. I mean, not always, right? It could just be backpedaling. But there is an element of that in here where he's kind of saying, like, look, I was sort of wrong about some of these things.
Right. And we're going to go over some of these sites in just a minute. But just to add insult to injury, he continues to talk about the transfer from the lost Ice Age civilization here. Mm-hmm. He says goes all the way back to the Natufians.
Yes.
Which go all the way back 15,000 years, which is thousands of years before the catastrophe that destroyed Atlantis, according to Solon.
Which then destroys his theory that this is the result of some visiting high-tech person that left their culture because of the catastrophe.
Right, because the bottom line is that the most intricate and the peak of this Natufian megalithic culture is Göbekli Tepe, which dates to the date of the catastrophe of Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
So, right. So that, what did they get over there that day and build it?
Right, right. But he's also saying the opposite thing here, right? That the technology transfer happened way before Göbekli Tepe.
Yeah, so I guess the Atlanteans...
The technology transfer is not... You don't need that. You do not need that to explain any of this.
It's completely not useful here.
And so that's why he now looks like he's backpedaling, right? Because he's taking this theory that he put out there and, you know, looking at the other information. Oh, well, you know, I guess actually it was gradual. It wasn't this sudden thing that happened. But it's not working now. It's a weird oversight. It's like as weird as the oversight when he says this is the oldest megalithic site in the world, when quite obviously that's very likely not the case.
So the Sabark reliefs that we kicked off the show with here, I find fascinating because they have both types of bas-relief that are in the Göbekli Tepe enclosures.
Yeah, yeah.
So clearly these are the same artisans that were taught at the same school of carving. And the fact that these motifs have existed now for 12,000 years is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
And they didn't just invent it here at Göbekli Tepe. This is coming from a time much earlier.
Yeah. 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 Oh, by the way, I want to point something out too. Hancock talks about in the blog piece, and apparently I never watched the Netflix episode. So, but he says that he, in the Netflix episode, he talks about, the work of, Sweatman. I think it's Martin Sweatman, and Sitricus, which we have reviewed, in a couple of episodes. And one of the most fascinating episodes we've ever done, in my opinion, talking about Pillar 43 and how, you can quite specifically look at that as a, astronomical, you know, dating system for something that happened. And I actually find that evidence pretty convincing.
It's dating to this drop down right here, 12,800 years ago, which would be the catastrophe to end the megalithic culture.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, this is the conundrum. The Egyptian priests, Solon, said that Atlantis was destroyed 11,700 years ago. So we've got two catastrophes which are competing.
Well, I mean, it's not like the Younger Dryas.
Did Atlantis make it through the Younger Dryas catastrophe? It couldn't have, because it would have been in the middle of the Atlantic while it's sloshing back and forth.
Yeah.
So something weird. We're missing something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the catastrophe of the Younger Dryas isn't exactly one catastrophe, right? It's something that happens over a period of, you know, 1,500 years.
The mass extinction event is 1,208 here. This is when the skies go dark. This is when the Carolina Bays form. This is when the ice sheet melts.
Yeah, yeah.
This is when the mega floods hit the Pacific Northwest. This is when everything dies.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the time period when the Natufians got very skilled and ended up creating Göbekli Tepe, which is dated at the time of the second catastrophe here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's completely bizarro.
Mm-hmm. It is bizarre.
Oh, man, I really wish we knew. All right, so let's take a look at some of these earlier than Göbekli Tepe sites that Grant Hancock forgot about. Here is Karahan Tepe, and this is a square enclosure.
He didn't entirely forget about it. He talks about a lot of these sites in this blog piece.
I know, but I mean in his opening paragraph.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
These sites are so indicative of Native American sites that we've been to, in the sense that we have these circular enclosures here called kivas that have steps and chimneys around the outside and pillars in the middle. It's the same thing, in my opinion. And here's a square one. We even have square kivas in the desert Southwest.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I find interesting, and this was talked about in the blog piece, is that at some of these sites, you know, enclosures like this, you know, they're basically underground structures. Like, they were like set halfway down, and the entrance would be from the roof because there's no other doors.
Which is the same as Native American houses.
I think there's probably a practical reason for that, right? Like, we're talking
smoke goes
about
out the top.
What?
You need a hole in the top for the smoke.
Yeah, but also, like, there's potentially protection from cosmic bombardment, right? Which, as we've talked about many times, is part of the Younger Dryas catastrophe.
Exactly. They're scared from things from above.
Mm-hmm.
So that is some of the shots of – why am I jumping up here? All right, let's just jump to Bankuklu Tarla. This site is dated all the way back to the first Younger Dryas catastrophe, 12,008. And what I find fascinating is these are not cavemen. Take a look at this down here on the bottom left here.
Mm-hmm.
This beadwork, albeit it's soapstone, it's soft and it's easy to carve, is just as intricate as any of the soapstone work the next 12,000 years. This is dated to 12,500 or older.
Yeah. By the way, the little sort of arrow figure that you initially pointed out all the way to the left there in the middle, does that look familiar to you? It's the same as all of the – it's the same shape as all of the, like, serpent figures in Göbekli Tepe.
Especially on that one pillar, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. Well, I think there's a couple of pillars with that, yeah, but
– and so this is 1,500 years earlier than Göbekli Tepe from the Natufians, clearly the same stuff. This is about 13,000-year-old jewelry.
Mm, beautiful.
And they just didn't learn how to make this 13,000 years ago.
Yeah.
It took – hundreds or thousands of years to develop this technique. Where did it come from? So this is the first thing that actually validates any of Hancock's claims that clearly this type of technology came from somewhere else. It didn't just spontaneously show up here at this site 13,000 years ago. No way.
Right.
One person got smart enough and they're like, hey, I just found out how to make beads and jewelry.
Right. Well, and again, that idea undersells the capabilities of human beings. Like, we just didn't do any of this until there was like one person who was a genius enough to figure out how to carve this soapstone. I mean, come on. Like,
this is awesome. It looks like an amulet here with a hole, but it also has the ability to have another leather strap here.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder what that was for.
Mm-hmm.
So at Bankuklu Tarla, there are pillars that are miniature versions of the T-pillars at Göbekli Tepe. You can see one here. And more interesting at Bankuklu Tarla, this site is fascinating. The newest papers that are coming out showing facial jewelry, the first evidence of on-purpose human body perforation. They've got gauges for earrings. And isn't this fascinating?
It's interesting. I mean, I don't find it all that surprising, though.
No, because it probably goes back 150,000 years to the first people. You know, just like I would think Aboriginals have been doing this for 100,000 years.
Yeah. Well, and it also goes to show, like if you ever have some idea that, like, let's say, like, jewelry wearing is somehow, like, shallow and unimportant or something like that, that's clearly not the case given the history of humans. You know, we've been adorning ourselves for as long as we know.
Exactly. And here's that stuff I was talking about, the predating. Here's the paper. When did it come out? September of 2023, the Younger Dryas later at Bankuklu Tarla and the beginning of a village life in the upper Tigris Valley or Tigris Basin. This shows that the people living here were here before the 12-8 event and all the way after through the entire coal period, all the way even past the 11-7 event.
Mm-hmm.
So they stayed almost, it seems like they were always here, and somewhere around 10 or 9,000 years ago, the culture really shifted and they named it something else, similar to what they do out here with Native Americans.
Right, right. When the Clovis suddenly become the Folsom people.
Yeah.
Because everything's
different.
Same thing
happens here. The people, I don't think any went anywhere, but there was a rapid shift 8,700 years ago, which corresponds. Here, what does that correspond to? Wow! Another cooling period. So maybe this is what shifted the culture.
Yeah.
They were happy for all these generations. Something bad happened, and they had to shift the way they were doing things.
Yeah. Yeah.
I find it fascinating that you can just look at these graphs and correlate everything. And with the Toba eruption paper, you can come over here and you can clearly see this massive cooling on Earth right here from Toba, right here, a drop in carbon dioxide, the opposite of what you would think would happen, and mm-hmm. a massive spike in worldwide dust because mm-hmm. of a giant volcanic eruption which affected the globe.
Yes.
So the proxy data is fascinating to use.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so what we should be gleaning is that this Natufian culture, which is amazing, they date back all the way over here. So they were here during the bottom, the last glacial maximum. They made it right through the Bowling Alarod warming. This temperature drop, they're still at the same spot. This drop and then the Younger Dryas catastrophe, they stayed there and they kept getting better at what they were doing, carving stone. Mm-hmm. And then we've got the hundreds of Göbekli Tepe enclosures, only 5% of which are excavated, are being constructed in this warming period, right around here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that based on that general story, the Göbekli Tepe enclosures are an encyclopedia of the last 5,000 years.
I agree. And
yep.
Ultimately, Hancock would agree with that as well. He calls Göbekli Tepe, he considers it like the apex and that it's a time capsule, which I would agree with. And then you also have to look at this argument about whether or not Göbekli Tepe and what's it called? I forget the other site that is claimed to be by some to be intentionally buried, you know, and now.
Karahan Tepe?
Yes. Karahan Tepe. Thank you. And now there's argument being made that, it wasn't intentionally buried. It's the result of like some kind of landslide or something. But what that fails to take into account is things like the fact that all of the pillars were still standing. Like, in order for that to happen, you kind of need an intentional, like, careful, planned burial, you know?
Yeah, and
there's other reasons why that theory doesn't work.
There is not enough elevation above the enclosures to account for landslides.
That's another problem. And then there's other issues in terms of the fill that was actually in those sites, and where it was from and where you can date that from. And all of that sort of suggests intentional burial as well. So, to me, that all lends strong value to the idea of the time capsule, that Göbekli Tepe was some kind of encyclopedia. We don't know exactly what it was an encyclopedia of, simply because we only have a tiny fraction of the whole site that's been uncovered thus far. So that determination really can't be made. I mean, you can guess. I mean, you and I had some guesses at this.
Yeah. So let's dive back into Hancock's idea that there's some kind of advanced culture that comes into this, to play here with the Natufians. Mm. The Natufians are here. And if you look at most of their stuff, they're pretty, it's pretty basic type circular pit houses that they're living in with simple mentates and grinding bowls. This goes on from 15,000 and it doesn't really change until 12,800 years ago. And at 12,800, we get the first of these advanced enclosures and advanced stuff coming in like Bonkuklu Tarla and Karahan Tepe and these other sites, including Göbekli Tepe with these stone pillars and bas-reliefs. We don't have it prior to that. So that could be evidence that some advanced group did start to mingle here.
Well, and one of the things he points out too, and I'm not exactly sure where on this timeline this occurs, is that at some point there's evidence of like architectural planning, right? Where you start seeing some enclosures that are more rectangular rather than round, or things that are set up in like equilateral triangles. But overall, it suggests that there's a need to do this sort of separate conceptual pre-design before building the thing. And so that seems to be a shift as well.
That goes all the way back to 14,000.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
So that would eliminate the idea that this catastrophe caused mixing.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think when you look at the broad base of the evidence here archaeologically, it shows a culture that lasted a very long time. Thousands and thousands of years, and we can literally see it advancing through time. And it was most advanced during the most catastrophic time on Earth in the last 130,000 years, culminating in this event, which led to the good times, where they encapsulated an encyclopedia of what they just experienced since their inception here at this place. It's
you
like
know,
their entire. Go ahead.
So interesting. I mean, I said this at the top of the show, right? Like the fact that this is a culture that's enduring for several thousand years through all of this calamity and obviously is enduring and adaptable. And then they, you know, build this time capsule of what they've been through. It's as if they know that things are going to get warm and human beings are going to start getting lazy.
Yep, and they're going to forget about all this.
Right. I mean, I've long believed that calamity really can bring out the best of us in terms of our innovation and our spirit. But it's sort of interesting to see how this plays out, because it is almost as if they had some futuristic sense of what was going to happen after them. And also, as we've discussed, there's probably no break in the actual people, right? There's just another level of adaptability where the conditions change, and so the technology and the culture changes with it. And then, you know, as archaeologists come in and just name them something else, like they're a totally different group of people.
Exactly. So what we're looking at here looks remarkably like Göbekli Tepe, including the hill, the peak distance from the enclosures, the slope of the hill. This is Karahan Tepe, and this dates from 11,000 to 13,000 years ago.
Amazing.
Yeah, and it looks like a primitive version of Göbekli Tepe with the same T-pillars, just not as big and not as fancy, but the same number of them, thousands of them. So this is telling us that when the Younger Dryas catastrophe occurred, they began doing this, and they did it for the whole 1,400 years until it ended. It was like a ritual that was happening during this coal period where they were figuring out the best way to preserve this information, and it kept getting better and better.
I'm fascinated.
It's so mind-blowing. There's probably hundreds of these enclosures here as well.
Yeah, yeah. And what I find so fascinating is the amount of effort and time that went into, I'm going to call them time capsules, building these time capsules. Like the urgency and the priority of that is, it's fascinating. Like,
They
like,
must
how do
have
you
had
have a
knowledge.
Whole culture of people that know that it's so important to preserve this information.
They must have known that the whole world was affected. They must have known North America was decimated. They must have known that it was a mass extinction and almost nobody made it. There had to be global communication still going on, and the information got to them, and they were like, that's what we thought. Holy crap, we've got to do something.
Yeah,
they must have known the scale, or none of this would have occurred.
Yes, agreed.
This is amazing.
No, it's totally amazing. And darn it, there was something else I wanted to say about this, and I've forgotten
no
now.
No paper on any of the things we're discussing, you know?
No.
None.
Well, and it also goes to show that, you know, this is part of the global high civilization.
Exactly.
Oh, I know what I was going to say. Okay, so there's there's some stuff being made out of civilization versus culture, which to me is just a bunch of semantics.
Yeah.
Okay, but you sent me a video today of, I don't remember the channel, but this woman who, in my opinion, was just, well, whatever, just launching ad hominem attacks at Hancock for the most part. But, you know, in the beginning of her video, she talks about the difference between culture and civilization, and that, you know, these certain criterion have to be met for something to be a civilization. And one of those things is some kind of language, which is considered to be either a written language or like a numerological language, right? So thus, Sumer was the first real civilization because they had the first written language, blah, blah, blah. But that does it to me. It's just freaking semantics, because when you build something like Göbekli Tepe or Karahan Tepe with all of this information that is being recorded in carvings, in images, the same way you might do that with pictographs or petroglyphs or whatever, that is a communication system. Just because it's not in numbers or words as you define them doesn't mean that the communication system doesn't exist. And it's so silly and arbitrary to me, because like, what culture or civilization or whatever you want to call it doesn't have some kind of communication system? You know, the civilizations can't exist without communication. So it's so silly to me.
The complexity of a single pillar in Göbekli Tepe proves that there is a very advanced communication system going on with the Natufians.
Right, right. So making this distinction between culture and civilization, it's totally arbitrary, it's total semantics, and it's nonsense and not important. So
yeah, I would imagine they had advanced language too. They just didn't need to write it down. Writing it down, I think, has to do with something, us getting dumber.
Maybe.
Or just maybe living in a different way where it became practical and useful. And because in Sumer, it was so that they could make bills and receipts. It was
right.
It was so that they could charge you.
Well, when you think about it, you know, recording and communicating your information in images is in a way far more efficient than doing words, because you can illustrate whole concepts in one image. And whereas with words, it's everything's broken down into details and really has to be drawn out. I don't think that one is necessarily better than the other. I think they serve different purposes. And maybe, you know, like you said, maybe we've just changed in the way that we think or in the kinds of information that we need to communicate.
Exactly. And they could have even been telepathic based on the yuga at this point.
Sure.
And so barring that, this does not necessarily have to be the quote unquote Atlanteans, because it predates that. But it shows that prior to the 11-7 destruction of Atlantis and the 12-8 Younger Dryas catastrophe, which was a mass extinction, that there was definitely advanced civilizations, because here they are.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
here they are, folks.
How can you know of the existence of Göbekli Tepe and Karahan Tepe, just the sheer size of them, and you know, which 95% of it we haven't even uncovered yet.
Yeah.
How can you not call that advanced civilization? I mean, that's
Göbekli Tepe has 9 additional hectares of circular enclosures that are still covered.
Right. and the purpose of which is largely unknown to us.
Right. So
because
here,
we're too stupid to understand.
So at Karahan Tepe, which dates all the way back to the Younger Dryas catastrophe, 12-9, all of the pillars are standing because it was intentionally buried.
Right.
And unique to Karahan Tepe, which predates Göbekli Tepe, Graham Hancock, are these single megalithic carved enclosures into the bedrock.
Mm-hmm.
Who's doing this?
Yeah, yeah. And also, I wonder what it looked like, you know, I don't know, 15,000 years ago, 12,000 years ago, because this looks like sandstone, right? So it's probably worn to some degree. Like if you look
right,
at that
and
face.
This is a swimming pool. The water flowed in here, filled up. You can see the water level right there by the head.
Yeah.
And went out this hole. So this is for swimming in, or maybe it was a ceremonial lake. Yeah, for bathing.
Or like a ceremonial bathing area. And,
yeah,
and you know what's really...
Knocks, the sun comes in the hole and illuminates the head.
That's a good system of with water flow, too. You've got the in and the out. You know, that kind of keeps things fresh.
Hunter-gatherers.
Full of water. What?
Hunter-gatherers.
Yeah, they're just hunter gatherers. Now it's quite possible that these people really were hunter gatherers, right? And the evidence would sort of suggest that based on the kinds of food remains, et cetera, that you find there. But eventually, like you know, if you're at this site all the time, eventually you're going to start experimenting with other things you can eat, and you know, can I grow this and cultivate it for future use? Like to me, that seems like a natural outgrowth of being in one place.
Yep, and these people at the same time are experimenting with growing local grains. So they just went into the woods, what they were originally collecting, and said, hey, why don't we just collect some of these and plant them near our house?
Well, how about this, too? I mean, okay, you've got a group of people in one place living through climactic, extreme drastic climactic changes, which means that the food that you're foraging, whether it be hunting or wild foraging of plants, is going to be changing on a regular basis, which is going to make collecting food more difficult. So you could potentially argue that trying to start agriculture in this setting makes a lot of sense because it may be more reliable.
Right, especially because this really got kickstarted 12,800 years ago after the cosmic catastrophe.
Yes.
It was the cosmic catastrophe that jump-started these people into doing all this.
Yeah, yeah.
They weren't doing anything like this prior to that catastrophe.
Yeah, which I mean, it's just so fascinating, right? Because the typical image, it's like climactic catastrophe happens and everybody's running for the hills and struggling to survive and whatever. But no, these people are like, okay, now let's just like sit down and think about this. Like, what's the most important thing that we do here? It's to, you know, find another way to survive here, but also to worship and to collect all of this information for future generations because we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, that's amazing.
And the depiction of the face here.
Yeah.
Very interesting. That, I mean.
Oh, so if this was a swimming pool and this is sandstone, well, that would help explain why everything looks rather eroded.
Yeah, and look at these nice little shelves and nooks and crannies above the waterline. See mm-hmm. the water went here? They could have had candles or bouquets and... Who knows? This is just an amazing look. This is just one part of Karahan Tepe. Look at these pillars here that are extending from the outcrop.
Yeah.
This is a very advanced culture.
Yeah.
And this is also Karahan Tepe. We've got this giant, what appears to be a wild boar sitting on. There's those snakes again.
Yeah.
Same at Ban Kuklu Tarla. There's an H block.
Yep.
There's a giant wiener.
Yeah. This guy looks like he's starving, though. Like, it kind of looks like his ribs are showing. I wonder
his
what that's
about.
His ribs
are showing, but he's got the Moai hands grabbing his weenie.
Yeah, indeed.
He's not really starving. Here's his side shot. He looks pretty good. They were just...
No, I don't think that's what that's supposed to suggest. It just kind of looks that way.
They were depicting the knowledge of anatomy.
Hmm, maybe. I mean...
13 ribs. They
with
knew
the
that.
Phallus in the
they
front.
They put 13 ribs here.
There's 13?
Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13.
Interesting. Interesting. And then
and
with
a
the,
square
the,
right in the middle. Look at that. See that square?
Yep. Well, it reminds me of the belt on the belt that shows up at Göbekli Tepe and at Easter Island.
Oh, yeah. But so they could not put the belt here because they needed the wiener.
Yeah, and then the hands coming forward. I mean, I always wonder, I mean, we've talked about this many times, but if this is more like a spiritual symbol about how the universe works and how, you know, like the fertility of the universe of sorts, if that makes any sense.
And what nationality do you look at this guy with the beard? What looks like a big beard?
I don't know. I can't tell. Something come to mind for you?
Huh?
What? Does something come to mind for you?
No, but yeah, like Nordic, because the beard, something Nordic.
The nose is broken off. You can see that in the side profile and the front.
Might even have a helmet or a hat on.
Yeah, maybe. Yep. Interesting. Yeah,
absolutely fascinating. And so this is probably only 10% excavated at Karahan Tepe, less than 10% excavated at Göbekli Tepe. So in order to create what appears to be thousands and thousands of ceremonial stone enclosures, amazing carvings, swimming pools or whatever they were, a spa, a 13,000-year-old spa with a statue of a guy holding his weenie, all of this, you need, I would suggest, tens of thousands of people in this place for all of that time, for thousands of years or more.
Yes. Can you go back
It's not like 1,500 people are doing this.
No. Can you go back to the swimming pool image for a second?
Which one?
That one, yeah. Does it look to you like, go to the other one? Does it look to you like, I can't quite tell here, like there's, maybe this is not a good image, two central pillars and then everything else around it? Because one of the things that we talked about at Göbekli Tepe is a lot of the enclosures, at least the ones we have seen so far, appear to have like two central pillars and then other stuff happening around them. And I was hypothesizing that maybe these are binary star systems.
Hmm.
I don't know if that's really present here.
This is the only thin thing that looks like a T-pillar in the Göbekli. But these also look like T-pillars, but they call them phalluses for some reason because of the penis man.
Oh, is this the penis room?
Yeah.
There's some part of this site that's called like the penis room or something.
That's it. But it's actually a ceremonial pool, and these rocks probably, this part would be above the water.
Right, right.
Yep. So this might have occurred from erosion from the water.
That could be.
Yeah. But we would see the same thing on this serpent head.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
So they were carved that way. This is just a fascinating culture. A lot is being hidden about it because, and it's right in plain sight here, like the things we discussed today, any group of archaeologists could be discussing and publishing on.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're not.
Well, and instead we have, you know, archaeologists sort of arguing amongst themselves and... I mean, granted, there's issues with Graham Hancock's theories, but the way that he's being sort of vilified is kind of ridiculous, in my opinion. I mean, a lot of it is based on unimportant points.
Great show.
Indeed. Find us tonight on Magnetic Reversal News at 8 p.m. Mountain Time.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Hello, my name is Mr. Rowe. I am the host of Reality Extraction on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I utilize logic, intellect, and magic to methodically autonomize, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion and confusion. You can find me on Studio B every Thursday at 1700 hours Pacific Time. That's 8 p.m. Eastern. No topic taboo, no subject too strange. I strive to take a neutral standpoint during the dissection of the topic at hand. That's Reality Extraction with Mr. Rowe on Revolution Radio.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for Free Association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
Time, 2 hours of an organization to the madness, discussing the ever-changing dynamics of being both physically and mentally prepared for a plethora of possible outcomes to our future and present. A look into the latest technologies, new scientific discoveries, and how